This is another episode of the Masters of Beautiful Achievements. What can we learn from them on how they apply natural science, systems thinking, and personal leadership to realize these beautiful achievements? My name is Alexander Prinsen, and great you are listening to this episode. If you're looking for more inspiring episodes, check out my website, mastersofbeautifulachievements.com. The link can be found here below. These conversations are made possible by our Patreon and Gumtree community. So I want to thank each of you for your monthly or even your one-time support. Your contributions enables me to create these amazing conversations. So thank you for your support. When you're not a member yet, click on the links below to join and be partners of this amazing community. If you're interested in how I can help your business create beautiful achievements, choose one of my Gumtree offers on how you want to engage with me, or contact me directly via Scope Matters website. And now, it is time to enjoy the conversation with today's masters. Welcome to the Masters of Beautiful Achievements conversations. Today I have Brett Van Stone. Now, he's not Dutch. He is an Englishman who moved to the Netherlands to do something very special. He is creating cheese and butter, not from dairy, but from plants. And today we're going to dive into that and learn more about how he's doing that, how he's achieving commercial success, and also what kind of technology lies behind this and what kind of choices is he making. So welcome, Brett, to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
For setting the stage for who is Brett and where does Brett come from, could you share us a little bit what the past made you move in creating Willycroft.
Exactly.
Later on, I want to ask what that actually means.
I'll tell you now because it is part of the answer to the question. So I'm from the UK, as you say. So I grew up in and around Brighton.
From the south.
From the south, which I think influenced what I'm doing now more than I thought growing up.
Interesting.
Very liberal and environmentally conscious city.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the only place that for many years now has had an MP that's from the Green Party.
Okay.
So I think that it kind of infiltrated more than I thought. And my grandparents were farmers. So they were dairy farmers in Devon.
Yeah.
And they had a farm called Willycroft.
And Devon is in around there too.
Yeah, so Devon is basically in the foot of the UK, The southwest, the bit that juts out. I before starting Willycroft, I was building and supporting other founders with a number of different startups. So mainly sort of growth related roles.
Yeah.
But none of that was in food. So it was definitely a big transition into this space, real kind of new space for me. But I think there were quite a few things that I picked up that have really helped me today. So I was becoming increasingly frustrated with my own personal impact on the planet in the build up to Willycroft. I also studied politics at university, so I think I've always been a little bit activistic, a little bit political, I guess.
Or more... You understood the surrounding or the...
Yeah, I think some of the kind of underpinning policies I've got frustrated with a number of issues. And then I've always been very entrepreneurial as well. So I guess in hindsight...
So when did you start your first company? When you were 16 or something?
Well, I used to go to the grocery store, buy a pack of 12 cans of Coke or something, and then sell them for double the amount as a single can. So, there was a lot of little mini projects throughout my childhood.
You already knew how to hustle.
Definitely. I think hustle's a good word. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Swindle's too far. Hustle's a good, a good word. Yeah.
And how did you end up in the Netherlands? I mean,
right.
How does a Brit come to Amsterdam?
Via old Amsterdam, via New York. I was living over there for a couple of years. I took a media company over to the States with some colleagues, and we built that there for a couple of years.
Oh, really?
And then my partner.
And it was you were like the founder.
No, I wasn't the founder. I was head of growth.
Okay.
So I was one of the people in charge of setting it up in the US, but
yeah,
not in charge of running the business.
Okay.
So that was awesome experience, but after 2 years of being in New York, I was kind of ready for a new experience. And my partner, she got a job in Amsterdam, and yeah, it's a long way from home, New York. So I was ready to come back to this part of the world, but not so much to the UK. So Amsterdam was the perfect in between. And then I actually had, for the first time in my career, a real refresh where I had the chance to do anything, really. Mm-hmm. And I didn't start Willycroft there and then, but I really started to think for the first time, okay, where do I really want my career to go?
But who challenged you in doing that?
Myself, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, purely myself.
How old were you then?
I was then 26.
Okay.
Yeah.
Being in New York also prolongs your age.
Big time. Yeah, and you don't have the chance to think about anything when you're in New York. You're just in some rapids and you can only swim one way, and that's the way the rapids are going. And you either sink or swim, but there's no time to read, there's no time to think mm-hmm. about existential questions or anything. It's so yeah, that's why when I got to Amsterdam, it was the middle of winter. We didn't know anyone. It was perfect to really kind of think, okay, what do I really want to get done over the next few years?
That was 2018.
That was actually back in 2016.
Okay.
Right at the end of 2016.
Yeah.
So been here for just over 7 years, and Trump had just been elected. We just had Brexit, and yeah, the world was veering off in a different direction. Yeah.
And what? What, how did you move then? Why, what triggered you to move back to Derry?
To starting Willycroft.
Yeah, I mean, Derry and Willycroft, of course,
yeah,
very related.
Yeah, so essentially I was becoming increasingly aware of my own personal impact on the environment. Of course, one of the first things that you question then is your diet because of its consequence.
Okay, what?
I started reading a few books about the impact that meat and dairy was having on the planet, and they were really tough reads because my grandparents' farm was what I think most people think of here in the Netherlands when they think of a beautiful sort of farm. It was, they were essentially doing regenerative farming before it was a methodology.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful farm. Most of the cows were fed from grass grown on it. And yeah, that's what I thought all farms were like. So when I started reading about factory farming and the scale of it, I really started to kind of freak out a little bit about the impact that was having. And so I then decided, right, I need to change my diet. And
that's sort of also a life-changing experience.
It was actually reading those books, and it was it was actually more emissions than anything else that drove me to it. So of course you read those books and you think about the animal suffering as well, but I think the biggest factor was just the consequence of this one component of our diets. And I actually found giving up meat really easy, same with milk, but cheese was a different story.
But how did you compensate for your B12?
To be honest, back then I was not thinking about nutrition.
Okay.
I really wasn't. I just thought I'm going to find a replacement. And I think back then I just accepted, or I just assumed that the alternative would have the same nutrition in it. This was very early stage when I think the whole sort of industry was not so aware of the need to, you know, really think about the nutrition of these products. And also I think I was just a bit young and naive, to be frank.
Which is good sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm not saying I'm not that anymore. then, so I couldn't find any good alternatives to cheese and started to read up a lot about a lot of people doing some amazing things in other countries. So looking at certain processes and basic cheese making practices, mm-hmm. but with plants. And I started to get very experimental on my weekends, started to make some products at home using very kind of basic fermentation techniques, making some of my own cultures. A lot of the cultures were happy accidents.
Yeah, but and you got inspired from the knowledge from China, or?
Some fermentation processes outside of cheese for sure. But also there was a lot coming from the US back then. The US, as with many things, was 5 or 6 years ahead. And so there were quite a lot of simple techniques and recipes that you could use as a base. So I was adapting those essentially, and I started selling at markets in Amsterdam, which is a brilliant way to launch a business because you just get direct feedback and you really very quickly can understand if you have something that will work.
But Brad, you were doing it for yourself.
At that point in time, well, yeah, I mean, I was, but this was 6 months in. I think there was probably a few things behind the scenes in my brain going, okay, maybe this could be something.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing it for myself, but I was curious.
You found the taste was good. You liked
yeah.
it.
Yeah. No, the trigger to doing a market was I just had all of these creations in the fridge, and we had a bunch of people for dinner, and we brought them out after dinner, and everyone absolutely loved them. So I promised that group that evening that I would do a market in a couple of weeks' time, and that was it really. So I did a couple of markets, quit my job, and then for a year just started selling into lots of small stores and many more markets. And it was quite a tough year because I had to do everything myself, you know, create the recipes, make them, package them, deliver them, sell them. But it was very, very rewarding. And then at the end of that year, the question was, okay, do I just keep this artisanal and just sell in these outlets, but maybe a little bit more scale? Or do I try and solve the problem I had myself
mm-hmm.
about 18 months before, which was walking into a supermarket and finding good alternatives to cheese at scale? And that's the route we picked.
And you mean we?
Ah, well, we have a team now. Yeah. I mean, when I say we, I guess they didn't have a choice. They did choose to join the company, but maybe not that choice.
No, it's good. It's good that something from an I turns into a we.
I try not to say I too much when I'm talking about Willykoff, but I guess this part of the story is.
It's more you.
It's hard to put it otherwise.
Yeah, but it comes from somewhere. So I ideas come from somewhere. You need to prototype it, and
yeah,
once it becomes mature, how? Because that's interesting. Because once you decided to turn it into a business, a lot of challenges come your way. You need to scale it.
Yeah,
it has to be stable.
Yeah,
you need to innovate. You need to figure out which markets you have to go. You need to figure out maybe even your brand identity. I mean, it's very playful. I don't know if one of your advisors has an influence on it, because I read one of them was from the old Tony Schiacoloni.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't know. So Pascal definitely helped with a lot of the branding. She's been around for a long time. But the inspiration was, I was always a massive fan of 1940s, 50s, 60s food products from Southern Europe, because they're full of color, very playful, like you say, and even a tin of tomatoes looks amazing and really pops. So that was the inspiration, essentially.
Cool. Because it also brings it back the sort of the authenticity.
Yeah. And the roots of Willycroft, so maybe we'll dive in there quickly, but essentially, Willycroft was the name of the farm that my grandparents had. And I spent a year trying to think of what to call the company. actually for the first year, it was just plant-based cheese because I thought, well, better people just walk away knowing exactly what it is, especially on a market stand. And actually still the social channels, plant-based cheese, because I guess that's draws a lot more people in. But
no, it also defines actually what it is, and with no blah blah on top of that.
Exactly. But we went for Willycroft because actually a lot of the values of the farm I hold really dear. So it was a big epicenter of the community. They worked with a lot of other farmers, my grandparents. They had very holistic ways of looking after the hedgerows and the birds and the other animals on the farm. So actually I thought there's a lot of good lessons there, and yeah, the dairy farming needs to change and evolve and reduce, but I'm actually not an advocate of removing it, unlike a lot of plant-based brands really do want to just remove dairy, and maybe we can go into that, maybe not later.
It's now becoming polarized. It's very polarizing.
I mean, firstly, I don't believe that you should be 100% anything in life.
For sure.
I'm not actually someone that believes in that as a ethos. I mean, if you look at communism, there's so many things with communism which I think I actually really agree with, but in practice it's so hard. And I think when it comes to plant-based eating specifically, we do need animals as part of the most holistic systems. Regenerative farming
they have a function to play in the ecosystem, and the manure has to go on the land, and that's what the bisons did in the prairies in America.
Exactly. No, that's it. And would I like to see the end of factory farming? Absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
Would I like to see that replaced with lab grown and regenerative meat? Absolutely. And of course a lot more plant-based products. But I don't see a future where there is no dairy.
Now, where there is no dairy, you need dairy farms connected to the land, and industrial dairy is not connected to any land.
Industrial dairy is what I think we really, really need to remove. But yeah, going back to Willycroft, we just love the kind of synergy of dairy farm turned plant-based cheesemaker, because I think that is kind of what the future needs to look like. And I don't look at my grandparents and think, God, they farmed for 50 years. What an awful thing to have done. I think, wow, that was amazing. They fed people after the Second World War. They created incredible community.
But as you mentioned, dairy farming as it should be is fertilizing the soil, because you have good manure.
Yeah.
If you have shit manure, you have all the problems with fertilizing your soil. But if you farm more within the rhythm of nature and the principles of nature, your manure becomes an asset.
Yeah, for sure.
And then it's logic. I mean, it's weird here in the Netherlands. We only have dairy farming.
Mm.
If you go back in history, there used to be trees on those dairy farms.
Mm.
Only the Dutch decided to conquer the world with their sailing ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed wood.
Mm.
So they chopped down every tree they could find.
Mm.
And what to do with that degraded land? Oh, we put sheep on them, because sheep can easily walk on softer soil.
Right.
And then they said, okay, but we can conquer the water level. So then we lower the level and put cows on it.
Mm.
So that's sort of my interpretation how the dairy industry in the Netherlands became big.
Yeah, and also after the Second World War, it was so incentivized, and the subsidies still stand today. And this is another enormous topic to get into, where subsidies go. And yeah, this is another thing which I think massively needs to change, because we are still, and this is the same with oil and gas, we're still
offering a
price that should not really be the price that we should be paying. It should be much higher. And then we have these solutions that can lower emissions that we then penalize. Like, we are in essence paying an absolute premium for everything when we're the ones offering a solution. So it's subsidies frustrate me.
Like everybody who's innovating at the moment.
Yeah.
But then you decided that your vegetarian cheese, or to put it more precisely, your plant-based cheese.
Yeah.
Started to get attention in for all places in Amsterdam. And yet fermentation is at the core of what you do, which makes me curious, because you only have an office, like only website was like 8, 10 people. And yet you distribute already so much. So that means that there are somewhere you're outsourcing it. And how has that changed your way of looking at the company and the way you're now operating?
Yeah. Well, firstly, fermentation is coming back into what we do.
Yeah.
So the original Better, our plant-based butter, that is a fully fermented product.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the cheese line, we actually opted to remove fermentation because of challenges of production.
Okay.
So we chose co-packers for our products. You essentially have a few different routes available to you when you start a food business. You can produce it yourself, which has its benefits because you control the process and you can make a margin on your production. Or you outsource, and outsource allows you to have scale. It passes on a bit of the risk to someone else. And it's a totally different world. So it's also not necessarily a bad thing to have that specialism mm-hmm. there. So we went for the latter route. Speed and scale were our kind of desires there. And I think the food space was already new to me. So to take on a production site as well would have, I think, been too much.
Yeah.
And things grow and change so quickly in a space like this that you might buy a machine that is already out of usage in 6 months because it's too big or small. So we opted for co-packers. Yeah. And that's why
you're insourcing basically the knowledge.
Yeah. So what we do as a team is we create the initial formulations. So we do all of the R&D.
Go back to your own kitchen.
Yes, thankfully it's not my kitchen anymore. Otherwise my partner would probably have split up with me. So we formulate all of the recipes and processes. We actually are quite hands-on in the scale up.
Okay.
Because we want to ensure that the quality remains, and we've actually got quite a lot of in-house knowledge on that scale up process. And then once the first few batches have been produced, then the producer really fully takes over, and they are in charge entirely of production. We do play a role in sourcing.
Yeah.
We're a B Corp, and we also have an organic product and actually primarily source organic ingredients. So the sourcing is very important to us as well. But then our core roles outside of that are we sell the products, but we also work with the distributors, because that is again quite a complex part of the food industry. You kind of need those bigger players. We do everything to do with the brand, we do,
yeah, of course,
but we do have partners there that assist, and then we do all of the impact projects ourselves.
And that makes me curious, because upscaling something from a kitchen table
is
a challenge
for
and,
sure.
And can you share with us how that worked?
Yeah.
And also what kind of fermentation technology you're using, what kind of microbes are at play. To make it clear, only the butter is fermented.
Yeah.
So the butter is then in connection with the beans.
Because yes.
You used to have, was it? Cashews
was the original base. So let's use the butter as the example in terms, and I'll walk you through the process to just getting this product to market. So we started the development 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Initially, we were basically trying to create a culture that replicates, or a fermentation process that replicated butyric acid.
Yeah.
Because in our research, that was the most fundamental component of dairy butter that we needed to replicate. So butyric acid, in terms of flavor,
is it also the largest component in dairy butter? Or
I'm not sure if it's the largest, but it's the most consequential in terms of flavor, because it gives dairy butter the fresh, slightly sour notes. So really the ones that you most identify with dairy butter. So we based that was the brief initially, was to replicate that. We have a two-part fermentation process. We essentially make a fermented soy milk. So that's the bean we use. It's European soy that we use. And the first part of the fermentation is the lactic acid.
And then you use the protein, soy protein, as your base.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were able to get an initial formulation that we were happy with after about 9 months.
Well, that's pretty quick.
Pretty good. And then the process moved on to scaling.
Yeah.
So we actually initially were trying to produce with a Dutch partner for obvious reasons to keep it here in the Netherlands. But the soy allergen was an issue for some facilities, which was a little bit strange because it's quite a common allergen.
You mean for the workers or?
Just for the facility.
Okay.
So because it is one of the main allergens that you have to declare soy.
Okay, yeah.
It's not a dangerous allergen, but it is an allergen nonetheless. And this facility had no policy for soy, essentially. So it meant that they couldn't work with soy as an ingredient. Yeah. We could have, of course, used a different bean or pulse at that point, but we were so happy with the end result that we didn't want to move away. So we then found a facility in Denmark that could use it.
And these are very specialized fermentation companies, or?
Yes. Well, actually, let me take a step back. The milk is produced by one of our investors in a bioreactor facility. So that facility is indeed very specialist. But the milk is then shipped to the producer.
Yeah.
And they are specialized in the sense that they exclusively produce margarine and butter.
Yeah.
So that the machinery is totally formatted to that. But actually, the specialism and the real protectable parts of the process and recipe, it's all in the milk. So if you're in the butter and margarine sphere, the fat composition of a butter or a margarine actually is fairly simplistic. You can reverse engineer that part of the recipe relatively easily. The fermented milk is where our kind of...
Yeah, sure.
Core technology lies. So it's essentially a precise fermentation process.
Because what I understand from fermentation is that you add flavor and it creates very interesting extra additional components. If you use the right, your mother culture.
Yeah.
Of lactic acid, yeast, and maybe some other bacteria.
Mm.
And it's all these acids that, I mean, that's what I know from sourdough bread.
Yeah,
every sourdough bread has a different taste.
Yeah,
just because the culture is very specific to the bakery.
For sure, and degree in temperature changes or adjustments to the outside air, all of these things have actually quite big consequence with fermentation. So that's why finding a partner that could recreate what we'd created on a micro level on the bigger scale was really tough. And I think the speed at which we were able to do that was awesome. So from the 9 months of the initial creation, we then spent another 9 months actually upscaling the process because we had to go through two different facilities. And then we are trying to produce small test batches. So we produced sort of 50 kilos initially and then up to 3 tons.
Yeah.
We sold those batches as well just to prove that they were functioning across a number of different types of customers, bakers, chefs, also D2C as well. And at the end of that, the shelf life was good. The finished product was great. Obviously, we designed the packaging as well alongside that.
Yeah, because I understood that when you use the protein from beans or peas, it actually has good solvability, emulsifying, and gelling properties.
That's correct.
Which I never would have thought that peas and beans would actually have that. I mean, it reminded me very similar of seaweed, which actually has the same characteristics when you look at algar and the other components.
They're brilliant bases for many different types of alternative meat and dairy, beans and pulses. Not all hold that that level, but they have a lot of protein in them. You do have to build up the fat with other components, but okay. there can be some amino acids in there as well. So they're very interesting.
And the fats are like sunflower oil or palm oil or.
So we use shea as our main fat source. Oh, yeah. Which is a brilliant base. It's nutritionally a lot more compelling. It's got a lot more healthy fats than saturated fats, because the vegetable oils, they tend to be quite high in saturated fat. And the most interesting part of shea is it has a higher melting temperature. So
why is that relevant?
Well, we wanted to not create a margarine, but a real butter.
And so, you have to explain that to me.
So basically margarine, because it uses usually either coconut or palm oil as the base, those oils, they dissipate. So they separate when you cook with them. So the coconut oil in the recipe will kind of become coconut oil. It separates quite easily. Oh. And then it also has a much lower melting temperature.
Okay.
So if you're trying to create something that can not only be a spread, but can also be cooked with and baked with, which is what butter is to me, you know, it's multifaceted. You need a higher melting temperature.
Interesting.
And you need it to hold its consistency.
Yeah.
And we've launched the product now for six weeks or so, actually live really on the market. It's in 5 Michelin star restaurants and all of those
places. That's amazing. Places when I read it on the...
It's really exciting, and all of these places are cooking with it. These are some of the top chefs in the Netherlands and Germany, and if it's good enough for them to cook with, then I think it's good enough for most of us. It's probably too good.
It never can be too good. If chefs...
Yeah.
If you can get the quality of the chefs to the market, then you're providing the right stuff. I mean, what you most of the time see is when you go to a consumer's market, companies take things out in order to drive the cost down.
Yeah.
And then you have the question, actually, what is left of the product?
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, that's the exciting thing still about the sort of HoReCa B2B space, is there is still a real focus on quality and performance, and actually also impact as well. The retail space the last few years has just had the bottom ripped out of it, because it's so price sensitive. You have the customer wanting to pay less. And then you have...
That is the perception being given by the industry.
Well, that is the perception of the retailer.
Yeah, I don't know if
that's actually true. But the retailer says that. Yeah. And then the retailer says, well, we also need our prices to go lower. And then inflation is going up. So there's an enormous squeeze going on the supplier. And who pays for that? Not the supermarket, the supplier.
No, they're not willing to do that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there was another product, a Dutch product, it's called Bone Food Producing. They created the most amazing burgers from peas and beans.
Right.
And then this guy sold his company to two investors.
Mm.
And they had the same issue.
Right.
They could not keep the product on the shelf.
Yeah.
It was costing too much.
Yeah.
So they decided to move away from those were the best burgers I could find in the plant-based next to the meat shelf. And they have moved back to the original beans, and they are relabeling. They're creating new products from it, because those shelves are affordable.
Cool.
In compared to the beef shelf.
Right.
And actually most of the stuff is just horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're putting so much other stuff to it, palm oil and all the other, said, the saturated fats, that you can question. I'm eating plant-based, but I'm with so many saturated fats, then is it actually still healthy?
For sure. This is the biggest challenge of the current moment, is the general standard of a lot of the products on shelf at the moment are quite low, so people experience it and probably don't go back for a while. And legitimate questions about what is actually in this product. You know, a lot of people don't recognize the ingredients, and question marks about nutrition as well.
Yeah, because that's what I liked about, the no palm butter?
Flower farm.
Yeah. Also, you're using shea butter, and it. I don't know. I never ate margarine. I only remember from my dad, but that was the older you get, the more margarine you have to eat instead of the dairy because of heart.
Yeah.
And the cholesterol. But this is the only new type of margarine I actually enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it tastes so much better than just margarina.
Yeah, that's the shea, for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Really creamy.
Yeah. And the butter is made from beans. What is in the cheese part?
We actually also primarily use beans as well as the protein base. Yeah. So we use a range of different beans. White beans, white lentils.
Yeah.
And then we also actually use some rice in one of the products. So it's a bit of variation.
And there is no fermentation in that part. You just...
No, we have some ingredients that are fermenting, some yeast and miso, but no fermentation across any of the processes.
Okay.
We actually are looking at putting a similar process that we use for the butter, so another precise fermented milk into some of the cheeses. So we will evolve the range from here. But to get this range out into the market, we decided this was the best route, essentially.
It was good enough for now.
Yeah. Yeah. And we do use primarily coconut oil for the cheeses.
Okay.
But again, that's something we want to adjust going forward. So
because from the pictures I can find on the internet, it looks like feta cheese,
the structure's really awesome on the range. We've really got that to a good place, and of course the usage varies, so coconut oil in the cheese is less of an issue because we're not melting these products at super high temperatures. But butter in a pan that's quite an intense.
Yeah.
There's nothing in between the pan and the butter. You know, it's got a it's very different.
And for sure. I mean, you go up to 500. I don't know how warm it is in a pan, but 500 Celsius. I mean, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was the cheese was also fermented and the cheesy flavor.
We started using fermentation. Those were the initial products. So I made the culture for the fondue, for example. But it was super hard to scale, essentially. But we're now going back that way. It's exciting.
Is that because the technology has evolved on fermentation? Because in that space, it's going so fast. You see very similar. Startups is always a flashy word, but you see a lot of companies of a lot of founders moving in that direction.
Yeah,
using precision fermentation.
Yeah,
recreating the flavor.
Yeah,
I mean America is big. Silicon Valley is.
Yeah, America, Israel, Singapore—they're really driving that space. There's a lot of movement there, and it's definitely an exciting space. I think we're probably 5 to 7 years away from having products on the market. I worry less about the legislative barriers. Some of those are already being knocked down. The big question is, can the unit economics add up? Because a enormous amount of money needs to be put in to get the machinery up to a place where it can be done at scale.
Which is the biggest challenge.
That's the biggest.
Because it's not there.
Exactly. They haven't actually created the machines yet which can do this at scale. That's not necessarily a kind of deal breaker, because this is often the case with a new industry. There's enough knowledge there that they know within a period of time they'll get there. But still, there are question marks over price, and we don't know yet what part of the market it will make up. There's still question marks with consumers about anything that is lab grown and GMO oriented. I personally would eat it. I think I'd want to just read the label a little bit, but I think I personally would. But there's a lot of people who are still uncertain.
But however, in the fermentation space, I mean, GMO is sort of normal because you modify your strains to do something. I mean, E. coli is one of those bacteria that is easily to be manipulated.
Yes, we personally are non-GMO.
Okay, but that's good to know.
But it is common for sure.
And actually, bacteria produce an acid, which you need, which either is a flavor or whatever consistency you want it to become.
Mm.
Which is good if you can have those flavors or those colors or whatever produced by a fermenter.
Yeah,
I mean that is the future. I mean, these bacteria are already here for how many billions of years, and they've done it to such a level that we still are amazed at what they actually can do.
Yeah, for sure. I think we need many different routes in order to reduce the amount of dairy and meat consumed.
Talking about dairy, I mean, there are, I don't know, I know the vegetarian butcher Kortenkaas, who moved into that direction because we know that bacteria can produce lactose.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you have found them and you can upscale that, you actually have your factory and you can add additional molecules to that to actually have it taste like milk.
Yeah.
Although it's not the real milk, so there is also a health consideration in there, because we can never replicate a cow, so there will be stuff in real milk which we'll not find in fermented milk, or lab grown milk. So these are sort of the considerations behind it. However, if you need lactose for the flavor and for the sugar, then it's better to have a specific lactose production than use the lactose of a cow and you don't need all the other molecules which you can find in milk. So it's a very interesting consideration, and yet it's so young space because we have no idea how many bacteria or microorganisms we actually need to create the flavor or to create the same product.
Yeah.
Because it's not one species, it's not two species, it's maybe dozens of species who interact with each other, and the end product is what we want.
Yeah.
And figuring out how these all...
For sure. Well, the specific example of those vegan cowboys, who are the kind of formation from the founder of the Vegetarian Butcher, they found that there's actually six different forms of casein. And so they've been trying to replicate casein. And initially they thought, okay, there's maybe one or two different types that we need to create, but there's six. And so that's one of the reasons it'll take some time to get to the place where they need to get to. So it's an incredibly important space. We also need to put realistic timeframes on it. Because creating a product is one thing, but then doing that at scale is another. I think the way in which the industry will look like in 20 years time is plant-based will be there. We'll have some of these more novel technologies, and I think there are other forms of fermentation that can be used. I don't think it has to necessarily be precision fermentation that drives it, but fermentation will play a major role. And then there will also be alternatives.
Like it has been in Asia.
Exactly.
For ages.
This is actually kind of the final piece I was going to say, is there are other alternatives where you replace the setting, but not with products as we know them. So one of the questions we always get asked is, why don't you make something different to what's already there?
Yeah.
You know, another type of cheese or something that isn't quite cheese. And I think that's a very interesting question. I think first and foremost, human beings are creatures of comfort. We know what we like. So I think that we need to replace what's there in order to create the most efficient change. But there will be many that want to just veer off in a new direction.
Yeah, which is logical, because if you can ferment soya, you can ferment any pea or any bean,
yeah,
if you want.
In dairy,
you
know, yeah, yeah.
Or in dairy or whatever. I mean, miso and tofu is also sort of a, when you, I mean, if you look, zoom out, it's also sort of like a dairy whitish product, soft.
Yeah, in terms of the umami taste and smell and things.
Some even smell like cheese in a way because of the butyric acid. So
yeah.
So nature actually has its way already.
A lot of mushrooms as well.
Yeah.
Really, really smell like...
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I did this foraging course a couple of months back, and there's a mushroom that we found that smelled like blue cheese. It's incredible. Yeah, I wish.
Or maybe is that mushroom actually being used for the blue cheese?
As in plant-based blue cheese or real blue cheese?
Let's start with what's now.
No idea, to be honest. I mean, you have obviously truffle cheeses, but but that's different truffle, isn't it?
Because the cheese you create is being influenced by bacteria, especially French. Yeah. The French cheeses are all fungi, yeast based. And then substituting milk protein with bean protein, maybe for the microorganisms that's not a big deal. For them it's like, as long as the sugar is there, and I'll change the consistency a little bit,
right,
as an outcome.
And
maybe you get those cheeses which you put on the table with 30 degrees, and the suddenly just starts to melt, and it stays, still has this tasty, I mean, it would be interesting. Maybe you could commission an artist to work on that.
Yeah, well, once we've got a real stable base, I'd love to explore projects like that, for sure.
By the stable base, you mean you're still...
Once we've broken even, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, which should be next, beginning of next year.
After 6 years.
Yeah, roughly. So yeah, it will be 6 years.
And when did the investors stopped by and jumped in?
End of 2019.
Oh, so, well, that's very last 5 years.
So it would have been, by then, it would have really been 4 years if it's early 2024. But yeah.
And why do these investors choose Willycraft? Are they choosing Brad and Margot? Because I think she's also the co-founder.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a combination. I think the opportunity in space is very...
Or just a crazy guy and let's do that.
Oh, it definitely doesn't go quickly, the process. I'll tell you that for free. No, I mean, I think it's a combination of factors. There's a lot of opportunity there. That's clear for everyone to see. I think specifically with Willycraft, the story has always resonated.
Mm-hmm.
The transition from dairy to plant-based. You mentioned the brand earlier. That's also always resonated. I think we're also trying to do things in quite a holistic way.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to create products that taste and function like the product they're replacing, but also making sure we have a nutritious story to tell. And finally, that we measure the impact that the products can have. Because a lot of plant-based products, there are question marks about what are the actual tangible benefits mm-hmm. that they are bringing to the table. It's not enough to just be plant-based as a producer. You really need to understand, you know, what is the impact that someone is having every time they pick up and eat your product. So we've done a nice job there, and I think that information is it helps influence better decision making from ourselves, but also it helps the customer or the buying partner also understand the impact that they can have.
Yeah, because the what you see nowadays, I mean, I mentioned Bone, which was a Dutch innovation. Not all of them make it.
I heard that 1 in 10 make it to year 2 and 1 in 100 pass that. And I think generally with startups, it's about 1 in 10 past year 2.
No, but especially in the food sector, because you're so dependent hospitality, restaurants, chefs, yeah. but with Corona, that one collapsed. Consumers need, you need to create a consumer base, which has to go through retail, but retail is not always collaborating with you.
For sure.
Although it has so much more benefits than actual meat. But they're only interested in how fast the product moves over the shelf, and the faster it goes, the better the profit.
Yeah, and how deep their pockets get.
And how deep their pockets. Yeah, so that means that either you have deep pockets and you can weather the storm until your brand is that big that the supermarkets need to put it on the shelf.
Yeah.
Because there are some brands that supermarkets cannot, Coca-Cola or PepsiCo or whatever, Lay Smith or whatever. Those are products they have to put on the shelf, because if they're not, people will not come to the supermarket. And then it takes time to become such a player, and you need to have a long breath and deep pockets to do so. So that means that you have two difficult markets. And you mentioned before that you're also moving to private labeling now to enable other brands to capitalize on your technology, because I think that is basically what will happen then.
Yeah, I guess the space is really moving in that direction. So beginning of Corona, before Corona, there was a massive move of new brands coming in, and supermarkets didn't feel like they could produce the products fast enough themselves, or that they had the innovation. And then since COVID, HoReCa has really picked up again, and that space is actually moving much faster than retail. And actually, a lot of the time, they want to work with new innovative products, because they understand that there's a lot more quality and evolution there. But also
the novelty, which I mean, these are all curious chefs.
Yeah, exactly. They want to work with new things, the best things. You know, then price is less sensitive there. But retail has become unbelievably price sensitive. And with that, there's been a real disregard for quality and brands, and I think the demands on
and the food transition in itself
it's slowed down a bit, and I think this is partially because of the focus on price. If we had a system where meat and dairy weren't subsidized, then already plant-based products would be lower than meat and dairy by and large, but they could be lower than meat and dairy with much better quality ingredients and nutrition. So we're creating our own downfall with the systems we have in place. If we introduce the carbon tax, if we remove subsidies, those two things alone, I really believe, would already dramatically impact the uptake of plant-based products and the quality of those plant-based products.
But how will private labeling then benefit?
So private label is really interesting to us, because we, with the original Better as an example, we can sell that product, but we can still protect the technology, because actually that part is very, very hard to replicate. And when we deliver to a customer, we don't have to do any marketing of that good.
For sure.
Or activate it. We're just delivering a finished good. So as long as the unit economics add up when we deliver that finished good, it's happy days. And then I guess to the customer, they're getting a product that is of higher quality than a lot of other private label options that are currently there. So that's a benefit. And when it's private label, the supermarket doesn't need to make the same margin. They will also put more attention to putting it in the right place in the store, activating the product.
I mean, it gives you as a producer, in this case, Willycroft, also the opportunity to scale faster.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to put the effort on branding, because that takes up so much budget and time.
Yeah. Yeah. And
opval is in Dutch, but to show that you're there in the space and
for sure.
That can take up so much time and budget just to make sure. And then when you when it doesn't pick, then you just suddenly collapse. And
yeah, well, you've got
somebody else can do that, which much more experience, exactly, and much more exposure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a totally different focus of the business, and you're competing with the own brands of the supermarket if you're a brand, but also big multinational food companies, and they have very, very deep pockets, and they can also, you know, stand the test of time. They can last you out.
Yeah, they can buy the shelf exactly. Space. But I mean, that is interesting, because if you go private labeling, means you can scale.
Yeah,
it's good for your investors. They become much happier. But that also means, from your impact and your vision, is that complementary to that? Because you mentioned Willycroft has its values from the agricultural.
Yeah,
let's say from the ancient agricultural practice. And I'm saying that dualistic because fermentation is also ancient. I mean, you're putting the cultures from the land into the lab.
Yeah.
So my question is, how do you merge those two, and what does that mean for the mission statement of Willycroft? And I also want to then move to your new idea of putting Mother Nature at the center, and what implications that will have for the business.
Well, we have to change the name that all of this feeds under, but everything that we're working on from a kind of moral, environmental, social standpoint doesn't change. So it allows us to create more impact, really, because the product that we're selling under private label is the same in terms of suppliers. It's just not under the Willycroft brand. So actually, nothing really changes there.
But will you still keep the Willycroft brand as a brand activist?
For sure. I mean, there's still a lot we can do. We haven't switched off our sort of branded channels. We just see a lot more growth with private label. So it might be that over time Willycroft becomes better known as more of a sort of B2B player, and so better known in that world than it is direct to the consumer. And I think the most important thing is that the products that we produce are produced in the most low impact and social and conscious way. And the brand that is put under is one of the less important parts. It's more the focusing on creating a high quality, low impact product.
How do you ensure the nutrient density in your end product? Because fermentation needs to be fed.
So if we look at the original better, that's a great example of where we want to move the whole range.
Yeah.
So we do compare to both the dairy product that we replace, but also other plant-based alternatives, and the original better scores brilliantly against both of those groups.
But I mean, what I'm hinting at is that, will you incorporate regenerative agriculture or biological, right, organic into the product?
Yeah.
Just because the nutrition density is guaranteed if you move to if you move to traditional farming, where the extraction of the soil
is
the standard, the nutrition density over time is lower than this when you ferment your product. It also becomes different because it doesn't. The bacteria don't get the stuff out of there, and you don't have the molecules you would have in a biological organic situation.
So this is an evolving question for us. We have one organic product across the supply chain. It's around 65% of our ingredients that are organic.
Yeah.
We with the original better, it's higher than that actually. We can make other products organic. So the original better is a good example of a product we can make fully organic. We've chosen not to yet with the other products for two main reasons. One is price. So the original better, for example, would be significantly more expensive, which means the market that we can service is much smaller.
Okay, can't you offer both?
production capacity is tough then, because we've got such high volume thresholds in time potentially. And then the second consideration is the quality of the end product. So if we look at this is more specific to the cheeses, some of the key ingredients that aren't organic, we've not been able to find an organic version that either provides the same taste or texture. Oh, wow. So there's a big drop off in the performance of the product, which is really important as well. So I think it would be possible to make the entire range organic within a sort of 2 to 3 year period if that was what we chose to do. Fully regenerative would be a bigger challenge. What we're committing to with regenerative farming is to have one ingredient regenerative.
Yeah.
And that will be our white beans. So we're starting there because we are working with Dutch farmers to grow the white beans. So we're 2 years into what will now be a 4 year project before we can get all of our white beans from Dutch farmers.
Because the reason why I'm asking that question, I also have a Dutch podcast called New Four, which relates to the Dutch agricultural transition.
Yeah.
And what I'm learning from there is that a lot of farmers want to move.
Yeah.
Only they don't have the market.
Yeah.
So you can only, I mean, the European Union wants at least 30% of the agricultural land to be biological certified.
Right.
So the only way to move in that direction is when brand owners take their responsibility, says, yes, we're going to move organic. And then that means that, let's say, two or three farmers can commit themselves for the rest of their careers. I don't know if a farmer is a career, but for the rest of their agricultural
Their livelihoods.
Livelihoods.
Yeah.
To that brand, and then you can work with them to lower the price eventually because.
Well, that's what we're doing with the white beans.
Okay. Yeah.
And that will tell us how we can do that with other ingredients. So the next natural step would be the fats that we have, because the protein base and the fats are the most consequential. So those are the two ingredient bases that we want to explore changing. I think it's realistic to have a regenerative product. Having an entirely regenerative line is too early to say, because the reality is that across the world, there's only about 10 ingredients that are being regeneratively farmed at any kind of scale.
Yeah.
I definitely take your point and question that we have a role to play, but it is a more complex piece than us just solely changing it. In an ideal world, we would be fully organic or pushing fully to regenerative, but price, quality, time, capacity,
especially if you need to make finally a profit.
Exactly.
You need to fill your innovation budget or your non-for-profit budget.
Yeah. Everyone is responsible. And unfortunately, not enough people in the chain are taking responsibility. Yeah. And if we reworked the subsidies, so a great example for the current dairy and meat subsidies would be if a large proportion of that was moved towards organic, and then no industrial farmers were rewarded, and then that would mean there would be a shift from industrial becoming plant-based.
But that's one of the triggers in the whole system.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm asking it also because you're making statements of making Mother Earth the CEO.
Yeah.
Which opens for me the space to challenge you on that
ethics.
Because I have a child, 3 years old now. Feeding him becomes a challenge when you get a better understanding how the food system works.
Right.
You start to question everything because you have no idea where stuff is coming from.
Mm.
They say maybe it's biologic, but to what degree is it biologic?
Yeah.
So feeding an infant which is more perceptive to pollution.
Mm.
And if you're doing that with a conscious mind, it gives you start to sweat because you have no idea.
I totally understand how you would see that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I want to challenge companies like Willycroft and others, to see if you can actually open up that space. I know from a business business model perspective, you need to show black numbers also for your investors. Otherwise, they start to question you and who maybe they start to take over the company, which you do not want. So I understand. Yeah. I understand you take the generic road, and then hopefully move to the more to the organic part, cost wise. But I would then I would say if you have the hospitality as a client, that will be and they are less price incentive, that will be an awesome opportunity to get that product line purely organic, and then help one or two farmers to go into the organic transition, and actually have them on your website or whatever. It's like we're working with these guys; they're moving in, they're doing the transition. And we're helping them. I mean, the first 5-6 years will be more expensive, and afterward, prices will start to change because they can get carbon credits and whatever else as support.
Right.
And the thing that I learned is that the current biological farmers have already their market base, so that is done. And if we want to have more organic farmers, we need to grow. We need to increase the demand, and it can only be done by brands and by producers who decide. Okay, we're gonna shift or mitigate. We move away from traditional products and we start to implement organic one, and then these farmers can grow or make the shift. And that is a cost consideration. It's a business model consideration, and that all relates to liability. I mean, can you survive when you start doing that or not? Which is valid. I mean, it's to do good is costly.
For sure. I mean,
I would love the support to do that.
Yeah, I would love to turn the dial faster than we are. I do think we push it as much as we can, but I'm always happy to be challenged on it because I would want to move faster on all these areas. I don't want to have any conventional ingredients in the products, but we probably wouldn't be around if we had taken these steps earlier. So I think we should keep being pushed, and I think it's also good to push, you know, the status of having Mother Nature as our CEO and you know.
How have you organized that?
Well, it's interesting because when we first made the appointment, we basically said, right, we want to basically place nature at the center of our decision making in a simple way. And we basically incorporate it on a sort of big decision making basis. So if we're moving packaging or supply, it has to be something that is having a net benefit on the environment. You know, that's the simplistic way in which we did it. We then created a movement, and there were a few structures that people had to apply to. So basically you had to have an industry recognized accreditation, be it B Corp or organic, just something that was well known, fair trade. You also had to prove 3 examples a year, which are similar to what I just said, where it was taken into your decision making, so it influenced the decision. But now, actually, what we now realize is to really say you have Mother Nature in as your leader, you need to be in a position where if the core people in your team or something happens overnight where you get taken over or something, no matter what happens, the values of the business will remain and Mother Nature will remain in the driving seat. And actually with Willycroft, there is no guarantee of that. If Margot and I pass away tomorrow, someone could in theory take it in a different direction. So actually Mother Nature is actually more of an interim CEO. Mm-hmm. Willycroft is, an advisor. If we're being realistic, and we've now with B Corp created B Corp led it. I think we've been more of an advisory role in the creation, but they've made a framework which takes companies on this journey. And so I think Mother Nature being our CEO would be having an impact board, for example. And actually we are implementing one this year. So having just structures that block non-conscious decision making, I guess.
Because I think Patagonia, was Patagonia the one that...
Yeah, so that's a very good example of, I think, a company that has Mother Nature as their CEO, because over many years they have taken steps that really protect the planet and yeah, it really courses through their veins. That's the most inspirational book I've ever read.
Yeah, and I know that the biggest concern of the guy who passed away, the founder, didn't he? Yeah.
No, he's not passed away. He just gave up his ownership. So it's using a steward ownership model.
Because what I've heard via, that his biggest regret or biggest pain is still that the plastics have not been solved, and that is one of his biggest
and organic as well. Yeah. So they were one of the first companies to use organic cotton, and he thought that would really influence the amount of organic cotton used. It's at the same level.
Yeah. So you want, and you hopefully also wanted to substitute the nylon and the plastics with organic solutions, and yet that is still not possible, and he's still unsettled with that. Plastic has a really good properties for outdoor clothing, and yet the outdoor clothing is polluting the outdoor, which is nagging his consciousness.
Yeah, horrible irony.
Yeah. In a way that, although his branding is good and it, the story he's sharing on his journey, I think is noteworthy.
Oh yeah, it's one of my great inspirations.
Yeah, and you need these guides.
Yeah.
To keep you sane.
Oh, big time. yeah.
Because right, I mean,
it's also cool to see that a company of that scale can put the planet at such a centerpiece of their business. Because it shows that that is achievable in other spaces.
Because that also one for you. Who are your inspiration, or who are your mentors? How do you keep sane, and how do you keep ensuring, or you and Margot, that Willy Croft will not drown in the rat race?
Yeah, well, I think we have different methods of coping with sanity. My personal method is a very good routine, and getting a number of things done for myself each day so that I'm not just solely working. So I have a very strict routine, which I do every morning without fail. I think also journaling and just reflecting helps me a lot. In terms of inspiration, I mean, we are quite blessed on that front. There are a lot of very inspiring people. I mean, Patagonia is definitely one of my favorite examples. I actually get a lot of inspiration from quite a lot of activistic projects as well. There's some amazing stuff happening in the corporate governance space, which is linked to Mother Nature. There's an organization called the Earth Floor Center who are doing really cool things. And they're actually changing the whole kind of conditions that a business in Europe has to function under. So basically every business in Europe just really at this point in time has to just report to shareholders, make money, etc.
Especially the CSRD will have a huge impact now.
Yeah, so now they have to have some level of values.
Willy Croft has to report?
We actually won't, because we are not of big enough size. It's really big companies they're targeting, yet indeed. But that has given me a lot of strength. And what also has given me a lot of strength at the moment is I'm reading all about Shackleton. And good Lord, they're in a shit situation for a long period of time.
Who was that?
Shackleton, he was the first guy to traverse Antarctica, attempt one of the first to attempt it, and basically for 18 months they got stranded and somehow survived. And I just look at that situation and think, wow, things can be tough, but they're definitely not that tough.
Is there anything else you want to drop as a final note for those who are listening?
No, I mean, I think businesses today, there is no room for just selfish profiteering. I think the whole basis of a business has to be to have a benefit to society and or the environment. I just don't understand how we haven't yet adapted our system to at least penalize those that aren't doing that. So I think it's a very exciting time because most of the solutions are there. It's just, what do we choose? Do we choose to support the solutions or continue to invest in the problems? I think focusing on the right things is going to lead us to where we need to get to. But will we do that? Time will tell.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks for having me.